That morning in March 1986, I stood in an ivory lace dress, beaming at a man in a black zoot suit who had just taken my last name. Our families clinked glasses, the DJ announced Mr. and Mrs. Winnick, and nobody mentioned the elephant in the room. I had just married a gay man, not bisexual, not questioning, gay. And somehow, against every rational argument my friends could muster, it felt like the rightest thing I'd ever done. This is the story Marion Winnick tells in First Comes Love, a memoir that landed on Oprah's reading list and reportedly sat on Madonna's nightstand. It's about falling for someone you absolutely shouldn't, building a life that defies logic, and discovering that love's most profound truth is its refusal to be categorized. When the book appeared in 1996, it shattered assumptions about what relationships could look like, especially during the AIDS crisis when fear was rewriting the rules of intimacy. What makes this story unforgettable isn't just its unconventional premise, but its raw honesty about what happens when passion collides with reality, and how two people can be both perfectly wrong and perfectly right for each other. Picture a hungover morning in New Orleans, Mardi Gras 1983. Marion, strung out from a bad breakup and flirting with heroin addiction, gets dragged to a rundown Victorian mansion. The door opens, and there stands Tony, tall, honey-haired, with a chipped front tooth and a smile that makes her forget every sensible boundary. Within hours, she's in his lap. Within days, she's teaching him how to shoot up. Within weeks, she's planning to abandon her New York life for him. Tony was a former ice skater, elegant, beautiful, with fluid grace from years touring Europe with Holiday on Ice. But when Marion met him, he was broken, recently dumped, unemployed after a DWI, having attempted suicide, crashing on friends' couches. Their courtship ran on marathon phone calls that cost more than plane tickets, drugs that dissolved boundaries, and a shared obsession that finally matched Marion's intensity. When she told skeptical New York friends she was dating an incredible gay ice skater, they tried to talk sense into her. Only Aunt Edie gave her blessing. Once you have found him, never let him go. They moved into a tiny French Quarter apartment with red brick walls and crimson drapes. It should have been romantic. Instead, it became a pressure cooker. Marion wanted him constantly. Tony could barely touch her. During a famous New Orleans flood, they were trapped for 3 days. Marion tried everything, walking around naked, crying, begging, even drawing anatomical diagrams to explain female anatomy, which Tony genuinely didn't understand thanks to Catholic school sex education. They made love maybe 5 or 6 times while living there. The rest of the time, they got high, achieving through drugs the merging most couples accomplish with their bodies. Their nights revolved around bars where the music drowned out the questions neither wanted to answer. By summer, Marion's $8,000 savings had evaporated. When a friend offered Tony a job teaching skating in Austin, they jumped at the escape. Marion abandoned her acceptance to Harvard Law School, a decision that made her parents call Tony that goddamn gigolo, and moved with him to Texas. Then came the defining question. Lying in bed one night, too wired to sleep, Tony asked, "Do you want to get married?" Marion said yes immediately. "Let's get married and have some babies." It was 1985. Tony had just tested positive for HIV, and they decided to build a family anyway. The wedding photos show Marion radiant, Tony handsome and eager, both stone-cold sober. Tony took Marion's last name, wanting to share it with their future children. They returned to Austin and started trying for a baby, carefully timing intercourse to minimize HIV transmission risk. Marion got pregnant immediately and quit everything, cigarettes, alcohol, drugs, even caffeine. Then, a week before the due date, their baby died in the womb. Marion endured a horrific labor to deliver their stillborn son. No explanation. The grief nearly destroyed them. Tony grew distant and nasty, disappearing for hours. Their marriage began to fray in ways that would never fully mend. By August, Marion was pregnant with Hayes, who arrived in a dramatic rush. 2 years later came Vincent, born at home on Tony's 33rd birthday, their baby messiah, half Jewish, half Catholic. From the outside, they looked perfect. Inside, they were slowly coming apart. Tony had started smoking again in secret. Their sex life had essentially ended. They embraced the family bed philosophy, though Marion admits she would have changed that arrangement instantly if there had been any chance of intimacy. They were raising children together while living as roommates, bound by love but no longer lovers. By 1992, Tony could no longer pretend. Severe headaches, thrush, and a T-cell count of 150 signaled full-blown AIDS. Mycobacteriosis swelled his liver and spleen, controlled only by pills and tranquilizers. Marion quit her job to care for the children during Tony's final summer. He insisted on one last trip north, celebrating his 37th birthday in his hospital room with champagne and photo albums. "I feel like I'm getting to come to my own wake," he exclaimed. He prepared methodically, writing letters, packing a cedar chest with keepsakes for Hayes and Vince, recording audio tapes so his sons wouldn't forget his voice. On August 20, 1994, Tony decided it was time. He dressed in his platinum silk jacket, lunched at the Four Seasons, spent the afternoon discussing gardens. After the children left for a sleepover, he changed into a t-shirt and cutoffs, surrounded their wedding photo with candles, and took morphine and Valium. Marion handed him a bowl of yogurt containing 60 Nembutal capsules. He swallowed it in seconds. He sat by the pool for one last cigarette while Marion watered his flowers. Before falling asleep, he removed the diamond earring she'd given him in New Orleans. "You wear this now," he said. At 7:20 that evening, Tony died. Months later, Modern Love played on the radio, a David Bowie song from the year Marion and Tony met. She started crying, as she now does at songs, commercials, beauty salons, tall, thin men, anything triggering memory. 4-year-old Vincey, familiar with her tears, suggested innocently, "Why don't we open the windows so Daddy can hear it in heaven?" One night, Hayes couldn't sleep. When Marion came to his room, he whimpered, "I can't remember Tony." He'd started calling him Tony instead of Daddy. Marion understood. As months pass, Tony slips from immediate presence into memory and family legend. The process is violent, like having a tooth pulled, feeling those last threads snap. If Tony were alive, they would have been married almost 10 years. Except, if he were alive, they probably wouldn't be married anymore. By the time he died, Marion had almost forgotten how much she loved him. Their love grew dark and twisted and hollow, but it never went away. That was their curse. Sometimes, while walking or playing with the boys, Marion feels a greediness for being alive, a survivor's half-guilty joy. One day, while driving the boys home, Alive and Kicking came on, a Simple Minds song Tony had converted her to. She looked at her beautiful sons, each with his father's sandy hair and long legs. They knew what she was thinking. She knew what they were thinking, too. So she rolled down the window and turned the radio up.